me pones un éxito. Si tú no quieres hablar conmigo, dímelo para yo no llamarte ni molestarte, porque nada más quedaba tú.
Real talk. Real people. Real stories. The He's Jizz Podcast. Yeah! Welcome, everyone, to another He's Jizz Podcast. I'm your host and founder of the He's Just a Social Worker Movement with another amazing show for you today. But before we get started, I want to remind everyone that this platform was built because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. And this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Aaron Johnson is a public speaker, facilitator, and touch activist who practices closeness as a way to break down barriers between people. His TED Talk, Chronically Under Touch, Why I Waited 12 Months to Get a Hug, speaks to the power of touch and how it correlates with our mental health history and identity. Aaron is the co-founder of both Holistic Resistance and Grief to Action. He takes the time to hold the stories of Black people around homophobia as part of the lifelong journey of interrupting oppressive systems that make touch balance a radical action. Today, we discuss Aaron's short film, Dark and Tender, which follows 10 Black men on a transformative retreat with the Chronically Under Touch Project outside Seattle. The men seek to reclaim platonic intimacy and tenderness through close encounters with nature and dissipations of gentle Black masculinity, restoring the vital aspect of touch by replacing violence and rough play with care, connection, and intimacy. Aaron, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for that intro, and it's so good to be here with you.
The pleasure is ours, and pre to us starting this recording, I wanted to outline that as a Black man, you are standing tall in power, and I'm honored to have you here with us today. Before we get into any of your projects, tell us a little bit about you and how you got involved into this work. Tell us about your journey and your walk.
I so appreciate that. I'm the middle of five. I live currently and was raised in Southern California. My work's scattered throughout the country, but my dad was a welder, working class, blue collar worker. My mom and dad both were pastors. And I think what's significant about who I am is the Chronically Under Touch Project, or CUT Project, is been centered as some of the most tender and difficult work I've done of my life, but it's some of the best work I've ever done in my life as well. So I think for me, with Holistic Resistance, kind of got me some ability to travel the country and meet lots of people. But the CUT Project is still sits as and still feels very new. You know, we're 8 years in, sits as one of the most profound parts of myself and my identity, and part of my journey is after my dad's death in 2010 is I had to learn how to cry again after 20 years of not shedding a tear. I had to learn what part of my mental health I needed to tend to so I could stay here and stay present and stay at my big work. And so a big part of myself is staying really creative from a city. My city I was, you know, I spent a lot of time in and live in currently is Feeling, California. It's a small desert town where you don't get to launch big ideas from, supposedly. And so I take the desert, the Joshua trees, the part of being raised as a working class, blue collar working family, and also raised poor, cash poor. I just was able to start to build some dreams. And to me, I've never been so inspired than working with and for my own people, and specifically starting with a tender topic of building platonic and tenderness with Black men. So that's been a profound part of my life. I'm a natural builder. I'd spend a lot of time with the earth. I love community singing. I love places where humans get to be authentically themselves. And I would say that really wraps up a big portion of myself. And I would say I had the best team growing up that I was born into. I got four siblings. I'm close with all of them. My mother did an excellent job of building an environment where we all could thrive and sharpen each other and soften each other when we need to. So I also will say that what's not on my resume is how profound and magic, from my oldest sibling to my youngest sibling, maybe the middle child, has been a big shaping force of who I am today.
Thank you for that. And you know, those of us that get to see you on Instagram, you give us a glimpse of hope of what the earth really does, because some of us who are working in the city, we don't get those opportunities. So you do shed light on that for us. So we welcome that and learning with you. Let's talk a little bit about what led you to embrace touch activism as part of your work.
It's a good point. I had a mentorship program that I ran for almost 15 years, supporting mostly African Heritage men, but I had a couple of their identities woven in over 15 years. And I had this young man, and my TEDx talk really wraps the story up, but he was the catalyst. He moved in our living space, on our land. We're on 2.5 acres there in the high desert. He was from Compton, in California, near Los Angeles. And he had never been in the country before. He was on the verge of going to jail, on the verge of doing all the things that the mainstream culture trying to pull him into. And his parents, you know, as a last ditch effort, said, "Will you take him in?" And that young man was in such a trauma-led experience that we were in emotional and verbal conflicts almost on a daily basis. Every time he had to go take care of our ducks or chickens or do the basic, you know, task around the little micro farm we had there, it was some kind of resistance to doing his portion as a part of his growth. And a kind of a pinnacle conflict for us, where we had the biggest argument, I realized that me getting angrier or being more upset was going to help the situation settle itself. And I remember inviting him into a 5-minute conversation that turned into a 45-minute conversation. And I asked a question. And the question was, when was the last time you received 3 minutes of thoughtful platonic touch? And he couldn't think of 3 minutes of thoughtful platonic touch. And what he could think of are the many hours and experiences of violent touch from Black men. I realized that one of the things he was navigating, because I had recently came to a pausing point of my 3-year journey of being chronic and in touch, and acknowledging that personally, that I think kind of seeded that question. I think back of what made me think of that question. And so I think about when I asked that question, it was the first time I verbally kind of articulated this idea of, I wonder if part of our challenge was that he was in a place of his body was used to violent contact with Black men and with Black people. And he had no memory, no place in his nervous system where he had consent or thoughtfulness, a platonic, thoughtful care and touch and closeness, intimacy with other Black men. And I'm here trying to mentor him. And that's his default is violent and defense. And so that's why I asked the question, now that I think back and examine it. And that was the birthing moment. And I sat with him. And at the end of that conversation, I said, "Are you open to a hug right now?" I said, "No, I'm not. Don't hug me." I said, "Cool. I see you down to talk about it." And I didn't realize that that was day one of 12 months of me working, experimenting. And one thing I did, I remember going online, I think the following day, and I said, typed in, you know, tender touch for Black men. I'll try to forget therapists or work groups or any kind of books that people had written that they had worked with somebody that was chronic in touch in America, that they worked them into feeling safe and having a platonic touch practice. And literally, this is, you know, 10 years ago, and the internet gave me crickets. I went page after page, and nobody had done any kind of modeling work for Black men in the United States. And so I was like, snap. And so I just kind of started build on my own a simple practice, really kind of piecing together things that would work. And so I pieced together my first, now we call it a comprehensive touch plan. At the time, I was just trying to save this brother's life. And so that's the first time we now would say, looking back, we call it a comprehensive touch plan. So that was the first seed almost nine and a half years ago.
I mean, that is powerful beyond words, because understanding the value of having someone help us through small tasks is almost impossible to even think about how difficult that is, because when we are taught these lessons, they usually come from oppressive, bigger systems, jail, schools were not meeting the standardized testing. So amazing enough, you were able to bring energy through small lessons and conversations. Big up to you in that way. I want to also talk a bit about this touch balance. I know that you frame this a lot, and this is part and core of your work. Tell us a little bit about touch balance, and what does it mean to you personally?
I so appreciate that. it's this work, I will say, is evolving. So you ask me in 5 more years, I'm sure we'll add to this definition. But as our best thinking as of right now, we find that the young Black men that I get the gift to work and exchange connection and learning with and from, that when someone is in a chronically under-touched state, that they often are leading their lives, oftentimes unconscious, with the Black brute narrative being the leading definition of the best parts of themselves. And so they don't quite understand the lineage of the Black brute or how it is woven into our culture, so normalized that it doesn't even recognize the origin story of it. But when that's leading, that is a commonplace, we'll say, where someone is in a chronically undertouched state. And touch balance starts with just acknowledging, who am I? Not what was forced on me or shown to me, but who am I in what I call a complete emotional profile? Where is my tears? Why is violent touch so normalized? Who has taught me how to even be intimate or close in a non-sexual way with my brothers that I call my brothers, but oftentimes I could be in a violent conflict with very quickly. And so touch balance is a combination of building a right relationship with oneself, building right relationship with one's village, and offering or answering the question on a daily and weekly basis is, who am I if I actually have my full entire emotional profile intact, specifically using touch as a little bit of a meter to find out when I can sit in my body and I can lead my behavior and not lead with trying to break consent. I'm balanced enough in my nervous system that when someone says no, I don't pressure. When someone says I want more space and from you, I'm not stalking an ex-partner when they said no the first time, that I'm not looking and celebrating behavior that breaks consent as a part of my entertainment, that I can track what it actually means, not just the words of consent, but how it sits in my body. When I have enough nourishment, we always use the example of someone's been starving out in the wilderness, when I have enough nourishment in my touch space, emotional development, that I'm not asking my current partner or whoever my intimate relationship is to do all the 20 years of healing, and I'm angling it as, you're being a good partner if you could actually hold me in ways that I should have been held by a village. And so when you start to recognize the lack of village around intimacy and closeness that's normalized in America, that is when we start to arrive into a much touch balanced space. And so, and that has its own spectrums, but that's kind of the starting tracking that I look for when I say we're arriving at a touched balanced space. We can hear no easefully.
And those of us that have been following you and listening to you closely, you bang this out by saying it's just human in their diversity. I love how you stack that, because it allows us to get connected in ways that we appreciate and when we're ready. And as a facilitator, it shows your expertise in being tender in that way and understanding, how can I support someone who's never seen this before? So I know that your struggle is hard and long, but I do appreciate that you welcome every aspect of what they do and honor that by, you can stand and sit, you can sit and wait, you can do nothing, but just being here is a pay and tribute to you. So big up again to this work. As we go further now into this, tell us a little bit about when you have to navigate resistance, right? Whether it's your own biases and your own internal fight, or that can be external to this idea of platonic intimacy, because I'm sure that as you were getting better at this and you're evolving, there had to be moments that you're like, man, I'm going to hit this barrier again. And I remember that I had this struggle. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. The majority of this work is resistance. Most brothers sit down and go, you're doing what? Mm. You want me to do what? That's the first immediate response. It's because it's unfortunately still pretty rare what we're offering. But what I have found, and that's why I think that starting point was such a gift. Initially, I was pretty exhausted and overwhelmed when I was trying to just get my first hug, a safe, thoughtful hug took a year. I thought, this is painfully slow. Even though we've closed that gap with a lot of our practices, I can't emphasize the appreciation of someone saying, Aaron, I don't want to do this. I'm not ready for this. There's a way that I give a lot of respect to, I'm not ready. And I said, no problem. I'm still here loving you. You're no less. You're no less valuable to our village in that context. We just want you to know we're here when you were ready to try this thing out that we were all born into, able to do, that we're here for that space. Secondly, I say, hey, I just want to have a conversation with you. We don't have to have any touch. So I'm not here to say you have to arrive at any point outside of your capacity, but I would love to take the time to make sure that you understand this is about us having conversations that we are supposedly not allowed to have with each other. And so even though I think a lot of people feel like Aaron's trying to make us hold hands, I'm trying to help us listen to the beauty and layers of emotions and tender parts of ourselves that a big, very expensive historical machine called America Mainstream acts like doesn't exist. And so I just hope that when there's resistance to the physical touch, that's not a problem, that's common. My invitation is that, can we have a conversation that might invite us, and it might invite us collectively to say, can we look at ourselves and ask questions so we can come to our own conclusions of like, you know what, I don't necessarily think that I can count on fill in the blank big organization can see all of me. And that's actually where the work begins. And so when I oftentimes say with folks, you know, touch is a part of it, but it's actually a small increment of us being able to see each other better, to listen to each other better. The biggest part of this practice is being able to flex the tender, profound power of hearing each other for the first time. It's ultimately in the background of our behavior. Look at the four or five things that help break through a lot of this material. Listening is fundamentally critical to this work.
I see you. Because a lot of the things that we had growing up, we would dab each other up. And that was a code for us, high-fiving, having the secret handshakes and doing these things within our urban communities that we needed to do to be understood within our blocks, within our sectors. And a lot of what we did not do was listen to one another, because status for us was represented by a negative. You had to be in the game. You had to be involved in either staying alive to eat and creating opportunities that were probably of higher in the risk factor. But yet you're here opening up those doors for, forget about what your past was, forget about what you are doing right now. We are here now, front and center, and I am hearing you. I am listening, because a lot of the years and layers of these tough conversations have been dormant. And you are allowing this to come. And I'm sure that this is going to come for you in floodgates. When this does come in and you're starting to produce this, you know, we come from the cloth that mental health used to be a taboo. Now we can have these conversations, and saying to someone else, I have a therapist, is even sexy right now compared to when we were growing up, that it was difficult to even say that I'm getting help, that I'm asking for help. Now you've poured it in into listening, which I think gives us another sector. So one more time, this is deeper than anyone can possibly think of. And it takes a lot of work and patience to get this going. And we are going to continue to send that positive energy your way. I do want to get into your film a bit. It was a smash, because right now, some of the things that I got to see early on in this film was dark and tender. You know, you get to understand, even in the title, you already are pushing buttons that for us as men of power, men of color, we struggle with that. So let's talk a little bit about that. What were some of the misconceptions, if you will, in thinking of the title and getting this project forward as you starting to get this put together?
You know, it's not lost. You know, I have a sub-study of cinema in America that we have so many subliminal messages where dark is always negative, it's aggressive, it's everything but tender. you don't associate any kind of, even darkness is like the devil. We have this kind of narrative that just sits in the kind of culture of darkness is violent, darkness is the villain. So there's a way that I was just driving, I literally was just driving, and I was like, dark and tender just popped into my heart. And I was like, I pulled over and texted my team. It was like, dark and tender is the name of this movie. But part of it was how many times that my darkness, my dark skin was pre-messaging ahead into people's minds that I was all of a sudden violent. And the last thing that people oftentimes associate Blackness with, and particularly Black masculinity with, is tenderness. And so there's a way that Dark and Tender says it so quickly. You can ask, I played with 100 different titles of that, but I couldn't find something that spoke to. I like a title that helps America think, even if they haven't even watched the film. There's a way that you go, what is that? What is that person trying to say? Dark and Tender, like, is that even a thing? Is that something I can even put on my shirt? Can I even raise my hand and say that's a part of my identity? And so there's a way that Dark and Tender does also allow us to interrupt the constant narrative that in the Western movies were as popular as Marvel movies are today. You knew who the bad guy was, get a black hat on, right? And you knew who the savior was because he had his white hat on. It's not even subtle, and it doesn't change as we go into modern day cinema, with small exceptions. So with that as a backdrop, I thought it'd be appropriate to just start to plant the seed and help people understand that we're here to just start to think differently about this idea of demonizing Blackness and darkness on the face of it, and know there's something tender, present that's worth looking at. And that's what I was hoping for in the film title.
Listen, and when you look at that menu, they got to have that black and chicken. So dark can't always be on that negative side. You feel me?
So
for me, at the end of the day, though, now you're putting this project together. And I don't want to get too much about this film because it's so powerful. You bring in heritage. You start talking about things that we looked at in the 90s, having the three mics and so on. But you pour into heritage and what this means to you and to our culture. What did it mean now that you're seeing this? And there's power in the conversations. There's powers in the singing, in the walking, just letting it all out. What was it for you that spoke to heritage and said, yes, I'm on the right track right now?
You know, I have a cousin that did some research and found on my mom's side, an elder ancestor of mine that was born into slavery and died free in Castor, Louisiana. And I drove to see her gravesite. And one of the things, you know, sitting there in Castor, Louisiana, their cemetery, as of right now, is still segregated. Black folks buried on one side, white folks buried on the other side. I'm from California, so this is blowing my mind. I got cousins that still live there in Castor up so much. Looking at me like California soft, but what's important is coming from California, there's a little bit of a distance that we start feeling energetically from the carnage of slavery and how much that can drop into taking our humanity. And I want to just bring a part that sits tender in my body. I went through the first time before this film was even being shot, principal footage for it. But being there, standing there in Castor, Louisiana, there's slave masters buried in these big old tombstones. It's very large. They have little gates, people that are still alive and the family taking care of them. You can tell the budget's been put into their tombstones. And there's little blocks. And those are where their favorite slaves were buried. No title, no names, a little like maybe 6-inch block above the ground. That's where the black folks that the slaves felt, that the slave masters felt was worthy to be buried next to them was buried. And there's something about sitting there in that cemetery where I look at what it means to keep your joy and your tenderness and your humanity intact. I have seen Roots. I have read those books. I've known it, but being there physically, breathing the oxygen, standing on the ground, the actual ground that my ancestors had to stand on to bury the other ancestors, and sitting the 20 yards away in a gate that says white folks are on one side where the slave masters were being buried and other white folks are being buried to this day, I really was able to realize how essential it was that when I have an idea or a practice that brings humanity to our people, to black people in the United States, I need to make sure that I get all of my soberness, all of my humility, all of my parents and grandparents, all the ones in my immediate living space and say, make this be seen and whatever it takes to let it happen. That's why I feel so special to be here with you, because every interview I have, every talk I get an opportunity to raise my hand a little higher and say, I'm not a brute. I'm a human. I'm a human with a complex and tender identity. And that's I kind of seed into like fueling me when I feel these spots of resistance.
You know, I keep hearing disruption in your conversation because there's still heat behind you. You are coming intellectual with us and you are branding the Cut Project as something that was created for the masses. However, there's still these small stories that I keep peeking and listening to that may have been hurting you even in, you know, film this. I wasn't there with you, but I can tell that some of that layered work is there for you, that here we are in tombstones that you can't even tell when a person entered and left. And let alone a friend of mine, Jackie Rowe, she talked about the dashes that are in between the dates when you enter and when you leave. But the dashes is what really tells us about that work, that unspelled of who this person was and what they represented. And yeah, so be it that they are still segregated in a way, shape, or form. But trust and believe, you keep raising your hand and we're going to keep listening to what you're saying, because we won't be interrupted when we do get the opportunity, and you are doing this justice. Talk to us a little bit about the aspect of having, like I like to say, grown men having to come together and understand what they were signing up for, because this was tough all in it, title, history. But now you're like, all right, this is what we're going to do here, and this is the ask. Are you guys ready? Because I know there's some history behind that as well.
Ooh, that, you know, I think about the complexity of making a film, of telling a story, and it is a profound experience to sit without any cameras, for brothers to show up and be emotional and to feel themselves and to be tender with each other. It is a whole nother level to say, let's put cameras on it. Let's put cameras and to be present the entire time. And I want to just take a moment and appreciate my brother, who is my DP or videographer for this film and for this project. Is it was so important that we had not just a Black DP to shoot this, but it was important to have a Black DP that was as tender and as invested in the environment that we were creating for these brothers to show up as possible. I couldn't have done this without my brother Bryce. And I would say that because when inviting brothers in, I have to tell them, I said, you have full consent to not be on camera. You have full consent to leave anytime you want. You have full autonomy. And every time, every moment you spend with us is a gift, but know that you are not ever required to be on camera. But every time, every minute we get of you being human is so important. And what I noticed is the brothers that wanted and were able to come, that they settled and said, you know what, Aaron, I see what you're doing. I am here not only to participate, not only to show up in my tender self as best as I can in this moment. I want to be a contributor to modeling my humanity for the United States and beyond to see. And that, I think, was so amazing. And there were some brothers, there were probably as many that weren't there, that said, you know, I'm just not ready. I'm just not ready for this level of vulnerability on camera or off. And I said, no problem. But there were the critical brothers that showed up, the critical mass that showed up, said, I get what you're trying to share. I've never done this before. Not on camera, and barely, some of the cats I worked with a little bit beforehand, but some of them cats I just were folks that recommended they had the capacity to hold this based on the work they have done. So a lot of them showed up with the faith that they were going to be cared for and loved in village. And that was enough for them to say, I'm going to risk this. And so for me, I want to just name that that was probably one of the most challenging parts of this whole project, is finding out how to bring a diversity of brothers, because we have a very diverse group of brothers, to show up and be held and to be contender and be a witness to each other's tenderness, which is also challenging to watch another brother be held tenderly, is also a thing. And so that was something that I feel like there's a way that, and I also named too, the Black women were a huge support to this process. They were like, there are so many Black women that were amplifying and pushing this out, going, my uncle needs this, my friend I know. There were so many Black women to my name as they were anchored to helping the invitation land for brothers, helping me find brothers that had capacity. So I want to shout out to all the Black women that really amplify this tender part of the project of the invitation, which is one of the hardest parts of this work, is finding the brothers that will say, I'm ready for this.
Women speak power. You know, in that, let's talk a little bit about these phobias, though. Part of releasing themselves to the art of touch comes layered with that. I don't want people looking at me in this way, that way. I'm not ready because I don't roll like that. What were some of the things that you kind of saw that needed to be broken or broken through in order to make this work and still to your work today?
Right. So important. You know, homophobia is something I was raised in. You know, I was raised in a conservative Christian home. So I was raised to put a big distance between me and the queer collective community out there. And I want to just name that before I could even work on other brothers' experience of their transphobia, homophobia, and their material, I want to give a deep shout out to my Aunt Clarissa, who was the first queer, openly, back then we call her lesbian, but now we would say kind of, you know, queer would be an easy way to say it, queer Black woman that just modeled. Aaron, think about what you're thinking, humanizing the queer community in a way that I never could have experienced. This is like early 2001, 2002, 2003, and just modeling. Actually, even before that, those times I was conscious and old enough to really start to engage with her in deep conversation. And she so carefully de-escalated my identity as a cis Black man and really paralleled my tender parts in myself, my early suggestions of what does it mean to see all people and to engage with relationship first and practice, I think I'm gonna say again and again, listening and understanding what the queer community was actually saying and really go deeper in myself of what is actually, what am I actually afraid of when I start to run my homophobia at the queer community, and what does it look like to actually listen and not make any conclusions? So what I found, one of the first steps that I had to take for myself before I even got to, this is 15 years before I even got to even reaching for folks outside of it, is what I had to understand is that my entire almost spiritual background was based upon me being a man, being that this was the way that God wanted me to be as a heterosexual cis Black man. And that probably is for me, but anything outside of that was therefore sin. And so I had to really expand and reevaluate my spiritual practice, even to allow myself close proximity to acknowledging that this queer community could also be a full human being in my aspect. So I had to cough this up myself, and I wrestled with this for years. And I would say the turning point for me was she asked me a question about if she was human to me. And I was like, you're the most human, loving person I know, second only to my own mother, which I so give props and her conservative background, make sure we had contact and a close relationship with my dear Aunt Clarissa. And when I couldn't imagine separating or dehumanizing her, I realized that this method of fear, this idea of fear in my identity had to start to deteriorate itself. And then I realized how many tropes that I identified as being a strong Black man as like not crying ever. I mean, we would go to 4 or 5 funerals a year and I wouldn't cry at any of them since I was 5 years old. I made a commitment to my own internalized trauma story of not to feel, to go numb. And so I started to feel, started to grieve. I started to really cough up what it means to see folks that might have different identities in myself, specifically in the queer community as full human beings. And once I got to that point, then I started to do that work of crying, touch. And as I started realizing what came for me, the first time I had platonic touch with a Black man, I realized I had been misled on what it actually means to be human with other brothers. When I saw that brotherhood happening, that's how I started to build my awareness for folks. It's like, what does it mean? What does it really mean to be in village? And that's where we start to build. So what is it? What kind of questions can we ask? And so for us, there's an exercise we do with some of the groups I work with, and I'll try to make this succinct here, is I'll get some brothers together and I would say, I got some boxing gloves and I got $100. And the first brother that knocks the other brother out gets $100. And these are like, you know, 19-year-old brothers. They got some gloves on so fast. They're ready to knock each other unconscious. And we never get to the point of throwing a blow, but they were asked a question. They were like, $100, say less. I will not just put that. I'll give $100. So it'll be a great video for YouTube later or whatever it might be. That thought be a joke. They thought it was funny. And I said, no, we're not gonna actually box. The kind of just took away. And I said, what you want to talk about is what does it mean for us? To same $100 is available, but I want to offer a sit In the film, you saw models several times sitting across from each other, offering a hand and listening to each other.
Mm.
And they're like, wait, Aaron, I got some questions for you. And why are we doing that? Why? I'm not gay. And all these questions, that exercise is meant to say, when I said knock each other out, you never interrogated why I would want y'all to do that other than the fact you're going to get $100. When I ask you to sit and listen to each other and offer a hand, offer some thoughtful botanical touch, I get interrogated. I'm not saying you shouldn't ask questions, but why'd you ask no questions about the violence? But there's a long list of discussion about the nonviolent platonic space. I said, this track, where in our bodies does that actually make sense to not ask any questions about knocking each other out? But there's a long discussion about simply listening and maybe offering some touch. And so that point is to highlight how unbalanced sometimes our behaviors, how much we've been conditioned. So oftentimes we're trying to cough up homophobia. We want to cough up sometimes how lopsided normal behavior actually is. And what it means to evaluate who taught me that this is normal to knock each other out, and who made it very terrifying for me, or what made it very terrifying for me to actually listen to my fellow brother and maybe offer a hand up while I do that.
Humans and their diversity. You know, the big piece for me as I was watching this is you can't help but get into your emotional bag when you look at the history of how our upbringings have impacted us and our lack of tears and our abilities not to come together, because we were taught by punishment, by getting beat, how things needed to be done so that you can be successful. Being embarrassed by your parents in front of everybody was the norm, and probably using language to detour or to restrict us from doing things. Oftentimes, people who see us because we are willing to put that glove on quick think that we're violent, but if they were to look at our history and understand that we couldn't cross the street until a certain age, our parents were so strict, there was no such thing as sleepovers, ain't no such thing, you going to such and such house, if it ain't with your brothers, you ain't going nowhere. The kind of things that we need to go through and understand as people of color, some don't really come in touch with. And a lot of that is layered because they see us as tough and persona. So when you come out here and you are dropping gems like listening is the first hug, pay attention, because there's a lot to be said about what touch means. Take us a little bit further around what you enjoyed most after seeing the film yourself and saying, maybe I should have added this or taken this away. But what was the biggest takeaway from you when you said, yeah, I got this?
Ooh, it's a buffet of miracles. I think one of the things that stands out to me is there's some class consciousness, and we're digging deeper into this every time we do this work. But to see a brother that has a couple of $1 million in his account in this workshop, and to see a brother in this workshop that doesn't know where shelter is going to be the next 6 months, reach for each other and go, I want to see you in this moment. I want to lay down our class differences. Watching that just evaporate in that container was a massive reminder that we're capable of tracking each other across class lines, right? And tracking, adding so much actual value. One of the other big takeaways I've had is how much I have grown in this process. I mean, I can't articulate who I was enough to who I am now and who I'm becoming from the inspiration of the folks I get the gift to facilitate, to coexist with, to take what we call scratch sessions with or co-listening sessions with. The amount of, so some of us brothers, we're thousands of miles apart. Some people live in like Port Townsend, some live in Oakland, some live in Colorado and Denver. So a lot of this is virtual flying, traveling is no joke for us. In my experience of this project, I didn't realize how much patience I needed to build the relationships, and also how much it has grown. Like my patience for brothers that have gone through carnage in their childhood that are arriving with open heart is reminding me how profound and how strong and how thoughtful the Black Village is actually. So that's been a huge takeaway from my body and my nervous system. And lastly, I was referring back to what you shared about what parenting looked like in low-income environments where we were, they have a lot of options. And that has been something that has been a lot of brothers' experience, and they still show up going, I'm going to actually reimagine what it might like to be a parent. And I think for me, I was in Atlanta, Georgia, and it was probably the biggest group of Black brothers I ever had watched this film. And it was two brothers that came out of the NFL. They both retired from NFL. One was 10-year retired, and one was just retired 2 years after. One played in the NFL for 10 years, one played in it for 2 years. One was young, like 24, and one was like probably in his mid-40s. And they were talking about how it was important for them to bring that tenderness into their homes, even though they hold a lot of masculinity as ex-NFL players. They carry such a profound welcoming to the process. And that kind of witnessing of that, of my film and touring this film, has been a model of how I have underestimated the level of emotional intelligence that brothers are ready for. And that's been a huge lesson for me. So I'll pause there. But that's been something I could feel the growth in this journey.
To me, that was the biggest takeaway of the film, is the sense of family. You talked about people being at different economic statuses. You talked about brothers being at an understanding of what it meant to be hugged or lacked or deprived of it, and what that looked like. And when you saw in some of your scenes, in the tucking away scene where brothers needed to be tucked in, some chose not to lay down, some chose to sit. And once again, you allowed that to happen. I'll take it further to even say, when we had tough parents, interesting enough, we always had a Nana, we always had a Mima, we always had an auntie, we always had somebody who was going to listen to what we needed. And ever so gently, these people were pouring into us some of that. That's why we wanted them around so much. And people thought, oh, because they always buy you candy and do different things. No, these people are listening, and they're offering that first hug to us. So for me, that was the biggest piece there, Aaron, where family was brought to the forefront. And those of us that don't have family, you can see that hesitance that they had, whether it was time to be tucked in and they chose to sit or stand. But I know that in that, I'm interested in learning, do you plan on having them come back to you a year later, 2 years later? Tell me where you are. Is that some of the things that you've been thinking about?
Yeah, so we just shot principal footage on the Big Island this last month, January. Half of the group came back together with another set of new members to the group on the Big Island of Hawaii. And we did an 8-day workshop. So the workshop that you saw in the short film, that was about a 2-day workshop. So we did an 8-day workshop, and it was profound. And so that's part of the reunion footage that we'll have of folks that have been to the first workshop, into the second. And then we're going to drop a little bit deeper into the personal stories as a narrative writer. We're in the process of shooting principal footage for the feature film right now. So any one experience could change the trajectory of the story, but that's the essence, is we're going to revisit and go a little bit deeper with the full, you know, 90-minute landscape as opposed to 18 minutes. We get the opportunity to really get to know people's tenderness and to know their stories a little bit deeper that you can't really do in person. I feel like this is really a docu-series right now. We're going to just bite off, you know, 90 minutes at a time. I think it's no joke to get the 90 minutes done. So I'm not going to go off the docu-series yet, but I think it easily could be. Well, how much needs to be looked at in this material?
Yeah, let the positive energies roam in the areas and paths that you walk, brother. I want to also think about the ways that you believe this is impacting the way we understand. And I know that you've prefaced, even in your TED Talk and other areas where you've shared, I really am not trying to cure mental health. This is not my role. I'm not here to make people better, fix them, change them. I'm really here to help us explore. And wherever you are in this process, you are welcomed here. Is there a point for you in understanding that there is so much that could be unraveled with this, where you can say, hey, look, if I would go into a deeper study, can I improve the crime rates? Can I improve mental health? Are there ways that I can improve standardized testing if I could get to kids at a certain age? Are these some of the things that are provoking your thought process at any point?
100%. You know, one of the more stunning pieces that's kind of mentioned in the short film is that there's nobody that has done any studies for Black men and any kind of outcomes that if a brother grows up in a home where touch, a platonic touch, and nonviolent touch is normalized, taught, and educated, how that impacts his ability to not be incarcerated. But what I will say, over the last 15 years, the 20 brothers I've been able to work at one-on-one in a small group, every single one of the brothers had almost an 80 to 90%, in some cases I would say almost a 99% of reduction of one thing consistently, and that's violence. But these brothers that were constantly in a place of violence, it has clearly de-escalated. When we get them to anywhere close to touch balance, that the one of the first things to go is the violent piece. And so I am, without having the actual research put in place now, it feels like, is water good for the human being? I would say touch is one of those things that's that obvious, that I feel that if I had the magic wand, say Oprah happened to chime in, or Oprah's people chime in, or Obama and Tyler Perry and any other billionaire that forgot, you know, what they want to put their resources, if we just happen to have a room with them and they said, you know what, Aaron, we're going to do the magic wand. We're gonna not even worry about budget being a problem. We're gonna invest in this element and all the other pieces around this piece. I could almost assure you, in any region or any village or any state or any country where this becomes the norm, as much as we normalize the NFL, if this becomes in the film, I talk about this in theory, if that little theory I talk about in the film about if this became a normal part of our practices as we invest in, say, after school sports, if we made this parallel, not talking about race to NFL, just parallel this behavior, I am convinced that it will be a bad business to be in of incarcerating Black bodies. That would be almost an irrelevant practice. It would be not advised to invest in. It would almost take the prison complex out of business. And my feeling in the generation, that's what I feel if this was actually invested in the way that I'm seeing the results on the ground with folks. It's amazing that when this is in place, how many parts of the Black routineer that we are almost feeling hopeless around when it comes to homicide rates and drug addiction and all those things. I'm seeing that when someone's riding a touch balance, a lot of those things are starting to de-escalate. And I would love for the universities that we're speaking at and interacting with to start doing some real investment of like, what is it to study this to see what the results are. Based on like 100 brothers or 100,000 brothers studied over a couple of years of what their mental health, physical health, relationships, incarceration rates, employment, mental health across the board when it comes to being in Black village, income, what happens when we actually have a balanced touch practice.
Big up again, because I feel that those of us who are learning from you today that have not learned about you or starting to understand, yes, if those big projects were to come, you will welcome them with open arms. But there's also that part of us that understands that those 1, 2, 10, 200 brothers that you've been able to touch, you've already cashed it. And that thing makes it most important for this work, because you approach it humbly. You approach it in a way of innocence that you're also understanding. And you come off like a gentle giant, if you will, being vulnerable and understanding to say, hey, I'm here physically, but I'm very young in understanding what am I actually walking into. And I think that part of what you were saying earlier is that every single time, maybe 5 years later, we may be having the same conversation with different outcomes because it's layered in that way. So this work is important. What have you discovered that you did not know about hugging now that you know so much about it? What has got you thinking like, wow, I didn't know that that was connected to that as well? Were there pieces for you like that?
You know, I, as much as I've been working on my touch plan, and I'm, you know, knocking on 9.5 years from or more of my process, I have been amazed on how much my energetic field, like, you know, we kind of break down the hug, you know, how many seconds do we hold each other? And how close do our waists get to each other, and how are we pointing? What's up the side hug? And we have all these assessments of the hug. What I've found is one of the most important parts of a hug is a hug starts many years and hours and minutes before you actually reach your arms out and say, I wanna hold you. That the hugs that we're practicing are really a self practice, that it matters that when I go out and I wanna hug a brother and I wanna hold a brother, that I have done a real investment of being with village with these brothers, and that feels different. And also, I realize that I have been underhugged. Like, I don't know if I have enough life left. I'm 42 years old. I don't have enough life left to get the amount of heart-to-heart chest holding from Black men that are down to say, I have your full humanity intact. Like, that hug feels different than the hugs of folks that are like, 2.5 seconds and I'm out, right? Respect that hug. But that piece that says, brother, I'm here. If you start to weep in this space, I'm here. Maybe not today, but I'm hugging with the intention that I've been preparing for this hug for this entire year, this month. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, for me, something I am right now, as I'm speaking to you. One reason why I'm speaking to you is that I am preparing to hug folks that aren't born yet. To invest in that kind of tenderness is really where I have learned to value that level of intimacy. Is this is not something you prepare for a second before it happens. Caring and loving brothers is a life breathe in, breathe out practice that we hold as a part of my own identity. And that, for me, is I underestimate that level of prep. It's like, let's be in constant prep to hold our brothers daily.
One of the things I saw in you early, and I shared this with you before we got on set, was your love for mama. What do you want to tell her about this project now that it's on? Mama, here it is.
Oh my goodness, I love your question. I would say to my mother, thank you so much for thinking about me before you had your first child. But when I came into this world, my mother had a practice that she would bring the baby that just was born, which would be my little sister, to me. And I was probably like 3 years old, and said, this is your baby. As long as you live, you tend to this baby, you tend to her, you hold her, you support her. And there's a way that that tradition of every child that came after that got to that same assignment, that my mother was so clear that her children had magic to be made in the world. And she backed it before we even knew how to talk clearly. And I want to appreciate my mother's long commitment to holding our humanity when our immediate community said, I forget. She never forgot that. She never forgot that. And I just want to say to my mother that I am going to breathe and work and rest and be tender like it was given to me. That mental shutdown down was not too big. It was the right size because she made sure she took her time and said, this is what this child needs. Every child's unique. And I love that my mom held on to my uniqueness. Even though, I'll say it now here, is I had dyslexia. I struggled in school, which is usually an easy equation to being in prison. And my mom said, you were brilliant. Every single day, the public school said that I was mentally disordered. I couldn't handle, I never get out of high school, I never get to college, never make nothing of myself because of my dyslexia. My mother said, I'm not confused. And so I just want to say, mother, I've been listening. Alice Chandler Johnson, I've been listening. And I will continue to listen. And thank you so much for that gift.
Big up, mama. And to all the moms out here that never give up on theirs, understanding that they pour their love unconditionally to us. We owe you and still are paying for it. And we do it with love and grace. Before we let you go, tell us how we can access the film and your next steps in this movement. The floor is yours. Take us away.
Thank you so much. You can go to cutproject.org and just click on the show and tell and watch it from there. You can go to my Instagram, cutproject. You can go and Google, which is great. You can Google it now. You can just Google, you know, dark intended, it'll pop up, which is beautiful when it comes to Google. It becomes Google, man. Tender touch for Black bodies are no longer ungoogleable. But that's the easiest way to get it. But show and tell helps this film go forward. You know, every time you're $15, that all goes towards this current big project. So anyone who wants to support can go there. And our physical sponsor is Color of Sound. And that website also is available. But you can go to cutproject.org. And that's where all of our trailers and information updates are set. And you can, you know, sign up for the newsletter and we will keep you up to date on our progress.
Such an amazing moment that we had with you today. You know, we start to look and listen. When we enrich our worlds with acts of beauty and compassion, we start to understand that kindness is the universal language that's spoken by few, yet it's understood by all. And these are the chosen few. Because on this platform it was built. Because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. But this is no longer. Our plight and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Tune in, friends, to another He's Just a Social Worker show, coming to another town near you real soon. We're out. Aaron, thank you so much for blessing us today with your uniqueness and your knowledge, brother. Keep on hugging.
Thank you so much. Deeply appreciate you.
Please note that the views expressed here are my own and not a representation of my employers and clients. Thank you for listening. We're always here for you. Just message us and we'll get back to you within 24 hours. Thank you. More than just at He's Just a Social Worker. In memory of my mother, Matilde De La Rosa. This is dedicated to you, Mom. Miss you so much. En memoria de mi madre, Matilde De La Rosa. Esto va dedicado a ti, Mamá. Te extraño mucho.